Good afternoon, everyone. Today's briefing will focus on our COVID-19 vaccination programme and plans for rollouts across the island. We flagged in advance that this session would be a vaccination special, an opportunity to share our plans with you and for the media to ask the many questions that I know they have. As the Department of Health and Social Care is heading the vaccination programme, the Chief Minister has asked me to lead today's briefing. Joining me for today's briefing are two people who have been at the forefront of our pandemic response and are now centre stage in the vaccination programme, the Chief Executive Officer of the Department of Health and Social Care, Catherine Magson, and the Director of Public Health, Dr. Henrietta Ewart. I will be handing over to Catherine and Henrietta to give you their update shortly. Once again, we are able to say on the Isle of Man that we are COVID-free, as since yesterday we have no active cases of the virus. As always, we do not know how long that will last. The cases that we have seen have stemmed from travel to the United Kingdom, and our citizens remain free to travel to and from the island under our current border framework arrangements. So it is likely that further cases will arise among people self-isolating at home after their travels. But for now, I'm sure we will all welcome knowing that there are zero active cases on our island. That as it always has been, it is down to the willingness of the public to comply with the rules and a collective determination to suppress the virus and protect our health and care services. So I offer a heartfelt thank you to the great Manx public, as the Chief Minister would say if he was here, for helping to keep our island community safe. Clearly, there is now a huge determination to get vaccines rolled out as soon as possible. Yes, COVID-19 infections in England have fallen during the second lockdown, but transmission, hospital admissions and deaths are still at worrying levels. Vaccination will help bring down infection rates and help save lives. So here on our island, we share the impulse to implement a mass vaccination programme. So the question is, how will we do it? Our Vaccination Programme Board is working extremely hard to ensure our rollout is safe, timely and effective. It is important we do not lose sight of the fact that this is the biggest mass vaccination programme ever undertaken. And while we have plenty of resources and experience to draw from, nothing quite like this has ever been done before. This week, we heard the long-awaited news that the first proven effective vaccine, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, has cleared all the hurdles and won approval from the medicines regulator. This is a landmark in the unfolding story of COVID-19. The moment we have been waiting for. A green light to put in motion plans to vaccinate our community against this cruel virus, and look towards a brighter future with real optimism. The vaccine can now be shipped from the factory in Belgium to the UK, and from there we can expect swift onward delivery of our share to us. I will come on to the rollout plan shortly, but let's stop to explore the steps which have led to the vaccine being authorised as safe and how the UK became the first country in the world to achieve this. So I'd now like to invite our Director of Public Health, Dr. Henrietta Ewart, to talk a bit more about the vaccine and some of the key issues around it.
Thank you, Minister. Yes, the news about the vaccine is extremely good, obviously, but we do have to be aware that it doesn't signal an imminent change to life back to normal. The good news about it is that in extensive trials, it has been shown to be 90% effective in preventing illness with COVID-19 in the people who received it. It stimulates an immune response, which includes both antibody production and cellular immunity. So that is also very good news. And it also stimulates that response in people of all ages, including older people who sometimes don't respond to some of the vaccines that we have. So all of that is very good news. On the caveats, the things that we don't know about yet, is whether it not only prevents people becoming ill with COVID-19, but also prevents them from actually becoming infected by it. What I mean by that is that from the data we have so far, it's still possible that people become infected with the virus. They don't become ill themselves, but they may be able still to transmit it to others. So that's something we have to bear in mind before we think that we can relax all our safeguards and protections from coronavirus too quickly. In terms of the trials, they have been very well done and very rapidly done in large numbers of people in a way that enabled us to get the results from the trial without compromising the quality of the trial and the amount of data, both for efficacy and for safety. So that is good news. And the way that that fed into the MHRA authorization process was via something that's known as a rolling review. So MHRA did not need to wait for a given point at which they would be given all the data and then have to go away and work through all of it. It's been gradually feeding through as the trials have been underway, and that is the main reason why they were able to make such a rapid decision about the emergency authorization of the vaccine.
Thank you, Henrietta. So we're nearing the stage of getting boots on the ground to deliver the vaccine. In terms of vaccination supplies, as we have confirmed before, we have firm assurances that we will get a proportionate share on a per capita basis. As you can imagine, there is activity on many fronts to get the vaccination machine primed and ready to roll. I'd now like to hand over to the CEO of the Department of Health and Social Care, Catherine Magson, for some further insight into the planning and logistics involved in this unique and fascinating project. So, well, apparently we wouldn't, because I believe Catherine's link has gone down in terms of technology. So we will move on. I was going to thank Catherine for her input, but we might have to come back to that later. So the process that Catherine would have described, if she had been available to do so, is that we are in a process that is changing on a daily and sometimes hourly basis. This is a typical complex distribution operation, and the mechanics behind the scenes we need to get sorted out. It is a modelling exercise like no other. It was never going to be easy. So I would like to take the opportunity to thank those involved in the logistics and planning for this programme for the hard work and commitment they have already shown in ensuring we have robust processes in place. We will share as much information and background context as we can on our web pages and social media challenges, and we will give further briefings on the way people will be contacted for vaccination, what they can expect, and what they need to do in the coming weeks. I now briefly just want to turn to the Ireland's border framework. I know that some people had hoped we would relax our current restrictions and move from level 4, where we are now, to level 3A, to allow close family to visit for Christmas. Today, Council and Ministers considered a detailed paper looking at the pros and cons of taking such a step. It is, as we have always said, a balance of risks. We have looked closely at what would result from a change to 3A. Our experts' modelling takes into account current transmission data in the UK, the likely number of people who would come here if we changed our borders policy, and thus the likely numbers of additional imported cases we would see. We have also looked at the winter pressures facing our health and care services, in particular Nobles Hospital. These winter challenges are compounded by the UK COVID-19 situation and staffing issues. We nurse patients returning from treatment in the UK while they isolate in hospital, alongside increased demand in virtually all areas. Put simply, we don't want to see pressures and demand increase. The safety of our hospital and availability of treatment and care for our population is paramount. I said we consider all factors. On the other side of the argument, we considered that being able to see our loved ones from across would be welcomed by many and bring positive mental health benefits. And we do not underestimate for one moment the impact that our current restrictions are having on some individuals and families. So we have weighed demand, risks, and benefits of changing tack now. We have signalled that in recent briefings that a very convincing case would need to be made to move from level 4. But at present, the risks are too great. So I can confirm there will be no change to our borders policy this side of Christmas. I know some people will be disappointed, but the risks of receding COVID-19 in the community is real. If it led to spread in the community, we could see the return of social distancing, wearing of face masks, and restrictions on social gatherings. We have enjoyed a unique freedom to go about our normal lives in the last few months. I think we deserve to celebrate Christmas after the year all of us have endured. But again, I do not for one moment underestimate the fact that this will be disappointing to some people and cause anxiety for them, particularly at this time of year. But I do thank them for their continued patience. And I believe that Catherine is back with us. So the technology is now working. So without further ado, Catherine, I will hand over to you.
Thank you, Minister. Sorry for that. The power cut in our house today, so apologies for that. So we now have a safe and effective vaccine. We knew that the vaccine was effective, but we now know it's safe. And I just wanted to express a personal message from me first. The elderly mum test. Would you advise them to have the vaccine? Absolutely. This and any of the vaccines is a must, as they are at risk. Our advice is based on two key principles, which we're all familiar with: preventing deaths from COVID-19 and protecting health and social care staff and systems. The government has asked DHSE to prepare to deliver a COVID vaccination programme from December. Whilst we didn't know when the first approvals would be confirmed or when supplies will arrive in the island, we have been working hard to be ready to offer it and scenario planning based on some initial vaccine characteristics for some time. We have a programme team and many others involved with that to ensure that we will deliver what is right for us in the right way, following the protocols in place. We have a strong track record in managing COVID, the zero cases, the zero contacts that the Minister refers, in delivering immunisations like the annual flu jab, or setting up systems, processes and clinical delivery like the 111 service in this pandemic. We will do this again with the depth and breadth of commitment already evident and respond to this enormous logistical challenge. Whilst doing so, we are very focused on ensuring continuity of other vital services in DHSD, and winter pressures is most certainly upon us. So we're going to use medical professionals to deliver the first vaccine. It's a very complex process in preparing the doses. We've already agreed, Timbal, to agree to change the regulations under the Medicines Act to ensure a wider pool of workers can be involved. And we hope that as vaccines become more practical, we'll be able to expand that list of professionals further. DHSE is preparing to mobilise clinical and nursing staff from the hospitals and community. We will also draw on GPs, pharmacists and other healthcare professionals where needed. And we have already had a number of offers of support. Thank you for this. But to help ensure that the department is able to deliver a large-scale vaccination programme without significantly impacting on other vital services, we are asking for volunteers to register their name, email address and contact telephone number by contacting the Learning, Education and Development team, ideally via email to lead@gov.im, or telephone on 685 716. Those selected to help will receive full training and appropriate supervision, and personal protective equipment will be available too. So the delivery itself of the jab, it's going to be a mix of delivery modes. For the main part, we will be setting up one vaccination hub or hubs. That is still being decided, but members of the public in the eligible groups will come to us and announcements will follow. In line with the JCVI guidance, care homes are our first and top priority along with their carers. This is absolutely because care home residents are very vulnerable and there are lots of vulnerable people live together. Health and care staff and then those over 80 years of age are our next priority. And in relation to the care home and ultimately those who are housebound, this will be the mobile side of our operation where we will go to them when we can and with the most practical solution. There will also be some peer-to-peer vaccination amongst health and care staff. Now, the logistics itself is actually a major logistical challenge. It's more than who, where and when, and those are the easy questions to answer. The biggest challenge for us is actually how we store it, transport it and prepare it. And people will have heard that the vaccines have to be stored at minus 70 degrees, then thawed. They then have to be made up into separate vials and then stored at normal fridge temperature. It's not what we call a normal draw and deliver jab. There are precise steps that must be taken correctly. It's a very delicate vaccine, and there are a restricted number of times that the vaccine can be taken in and out of ambient temperatures. It's also a two-dose, where the second jab must be given 21 days after the first. And then this in itself requires careful management of stocks and careful booking processes. So we'll be asking the public to be considerate of the limited flexibility we will have in booking and to understand the enormity of the challenges we face. These challenges have and are actually still being understood day by day as more and more information is released. To give you an example, only yesterday we had confirmation that a tray of vaccines, which is how we store and deliver, receive the delivery, can only be defrosted as one tray, which means the minimum number of vaccines for administration at one point in one time is now 975, effectively the number that are in a tray. We have a delivery schedule from the UK spread over the next 10 months, with a total number of vaccines confirmed of 130,000, all other than the vaccines, the Pfizer vaccination subject to MHRA approval. But in some cases, we have limited or no information. Our first delivery will be in line with this schedule. That will be the first delivery of the 975 vaccines and one tray. Vaccines will be available to deliver beyond that from the UK on a 24-hour rolling basis, and we will manage that delivery in line with our rollout programme. So the process itself, no one has to have the vaccine, but we really do hope that everybody will. As with other vaccines, the consent process itself will be required, and as we sit here at the moment, that is not yet available from the UK. Key with the Pfizer vaccine rollout is tracking then each patient after their first jab to ensure that they also have their second at the right time. We have designed a system to handle this. And as healthcare organisations, we have a long experience in maintaining patient records in the appropriate way. And we will be using the new 111 team to support the first element of this in the booking process. So, we have to have absolutely everything in the plan. We then have to have the vaccination on the island. Of course, that's critical. But when we have all these processes in place, fired up and ready to go, we will go. So we're at a turning point in the pandemic. We need everyone to hold tight and continue to keep themselves safe. A safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19 is available and others are in the pipeline. By ensuring that staff have their vaccine, we can be certain they are protected. And that protects NHS services for people through the winter and beyond. Rollout of the vaccine will help protect against the virus and a full return to a normal way of life. I'll pan back to you now to the Minister. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. We now turn to questions from the media. And first up, I have Simon Richardson of Business 365. Good afternoon, Simon.
Good afternoon, Minister. My first question is, what level of uptake do we require to effectively protect the population? And also, what plans does government have in place to sort of counter the misinformation that exists in the public arena?
I'll come in first before I bring the Director of Public Health in, who I'm sure will be able to go into a lot more detail than I can. But just around the false stories that are out there. It is unfortunate there is a lot of false stories going round on the internet. I, funnily enough, had a quick look myself last night at some of the false news. So, for instance, one that has been going around for several weeks now is a claim about fetus tissue being used in the viruses. It's not correct. The particular video that's been posted around a lot of Facebook pages refers to a study where the narrator claims they have evidence that what goes into the vaccine developed by Oxford is fetal tissue, but the actual interpretation is actually wrong because the study in question actually explored how the vaccine reacted when introduced to human cells in a lab, which you would expect to be done because you want to know how a vaccine's going to interact with human cells when it's put into the human body. Unfortunately, there is a lot of those false news stories out there. And what needs to be made absolutely clear from the outset is, although this is a much expedited process, and in fact the fastest any vaccination has gone onto the market, the clinical stages that the vaccine has had to go through have not changed. It has still had to go through the three clinical stages, stage one, two and three testing. It has also still had to go through the same marketing authorisation. A lot of the reason that vaccines are delayed over numbers of years, which again, a lot of the fake news is focused on how fast this has been produced, is generally around the fact of them having, the companies having to put up funding, because there's quite a lot of money put at risk when companies go to develop vaccines. There is also, obviously, the logistics of having people not just to conduct the tests, but also be able to monitor the different stages and then analyse. That is the bits that have been sped up, not around the way the vaccine is developed. It has still had to go through the clinical stages that it always has had. And I'll hand over to Henrietta.
Thank you, Minister. Those were very good points. I think your question was around herd immunity and the coverage that we would need to achieve.
Yes, now, that's right.
Yeah, the issue around that is we don't know whether it will achieve herd immunity because, as I said earlier, what it seems to do is to protect people who have had the jab from becoming ill with COVID. So this is really a jab that protects the person who has had it. So that's the aim of it, almost more than as is the approach with measles, for example, where you're trying to get herd immunity and protect the population as well as the individuals. With this, because we don't know yet whether it stops you getting the virus and being able to transmit it, it is possible that it won't act in that way in terms of creating herd immunity. But everybody who has the vaccine should be protected from the risk of becoming ill, and particularly significant illness, severe illness, death, as a result of having the vaccine. So we want the coverage to be as high as possible, and that's about everybody protecting themselves rather than knowing at this stage that it will create herd immunity and protect the population.
Thank you. And my second question, will people be issued with certification to show that they've been vaccinated against the virus?
There is no plans at the current time to do that, Simon, and it ties in exactly with what Henrietta has said, and Henrietta said in her opening remarks around we don't know yet if this stops people contracting the virus and then passing it on to others. So a lot of the reasons we've been hearing about certification is the wish to have sort of travel passports where people can come and go as they please because they've had the vaccine. Well, we're not at that stage because we don't know if the vaccine means that someone can't contract it and then pass it on to someone else. So we wouldn't be looking at that at this time. But I don't know if, Henrietta, you've got anything you want to add to that?
No, just absolutely to echo that. Yeah, we don't know whether you are protected from passing it on, so therefore it can't act as a kind of a certificate, can't guarantee that you're safe to go hither and thither without potentially being at risk of transmission.
Okay, thank you.
And next up, I've got Tim Glover from Manx Radio. Good afternoon, Tim.
Yes, good afternoon. I just want to focus in on this potentially passing it on to others. How soon in that process would that be? And if somebody's had a jab, are they going to have to, if in extreme cases, even self-isolate having had the jab to stop passing it on to others?
Well, I'll bring Henrietta in a second. The first thing that needs to be said is I've looked at some of the studies around this, and one of the things that seems to be emerging is although they can't guarantee that people can't transmit it on, there is evidence that they may have a lower potential of transmission that's come through some of the studies. But if someone is showing symptoms of COVID-19, they would have to self-isolate the same as now at the moment. There is no plans at the moment to change the rules around that, but I'll bring Pamela to him.
Yeah, I just want to explore with you whether you were asking whether there is a risk from the actual vaccine itself that people could spread things from it. Was that part of your question?
That is part of it, but you were saying, obviously, I think we had connection issues, so we may not have heard everything, so apologies. But it was also, you were saying, there isn't any guarantee further down the line that people might transmit.
Yes, the first point to get very clear is that the vaccine itself does not use the virus, either in an attenuated form or an inactivated form or any other form. What it uses is a tiny piece of viral RNA, which codes for protein, and it actually codes for the spike protein, which is the things that stick out on the pictures of the coronavirus that you'll have seen. And when those get into the human body, the vaccine gets taken up by human cells, gets into the protein production part of the cell and starts producing that protein, which then stimulates the immune response. And as we said, that seems to stimulate both antibody production and T cell cellular immunity. The mRNA that was injected into them in the vaccine doesn't hang around for very long at all. It's very unstable and it is cleared from the body very quickly. So that's something to be aware of. So unlike some of the live attenuated viruses, there is absolutely no question that people might be shedding virus as a result of having a vaccine. That just does not happen. So as we say, that then leaves you with people who are protected, as far as we know from the study data so far, from developing illness. But we don't know whether that protects them from getting infected with virus and potentially shedding it and spreading it to others. But as the minister said, the evidence that we have so far is that if that occurs, the viral load that vaccinated people would carry seems to be very, very much lower than somebody who is either pre-symptomatic or with symptoms, and therefore the likelihood of them transmitting to others is very much lower. But we can't say that it's zero.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. A second question is, you're obviously concentrating on the more vulnerable members of society first. Once they have had the vaccine, is that a point when the Council of Ministers will be looking at border restrictions and maybe relaxing them then?
Well, we also need to look at what's going on in other jurisdictions still, Tim. So we need to look at the viral prevalence rate still in the UK. So one of the things I'm very keen is that this isn't just seen as a silver bullet, that suddenly we're going to get this vaccination and everything's going to be well with the world. That's not the case. It is going to take time to roll out the vaccination programme, not just here, but also in other jurisdictions such as the UK. We will continue to review our framework around borders, but it will still remain mainly based on the actual prevalence of the virus, and that will allow us then to work through the stages rather than, say, the number of people who've been vaccinated.
Thank you.
And so now we shift to ITV and Josh Stokes. Good afternoon, Josh.
Afternoon, Minister. On the government's COVID website, it says the vaccine programme will take an estimated 4 to 6 months to complete. First of all, can you confirm that that is the timescale you believe it will take to vaccinate everyone on the island?
And not for everyone on the island. It will take to work through certain groups. I think as Catherine laid out in her statement before, obviously the orders coming through the UK and the NHS supply system, we've got orders coming through up until September next year that are already booked in. So what we hope to do is get the vulnerable groups out of the way in the 3 to 4 months, but that isn't everyone on the island that's going to be done within 3 to 4 months. I need to be absolutely clear on that. As the Chief Minister said, while it may be seen as a bit of a silver bullet, it's not a speeding silver bullet. It does take time to roll it out, but we would certainly hope to be trying to work our way through the vulnerable groups within the first 3 to 4 months.
Okay, thank you. And the second question, will key workers who have had the vaccine in the UK be exempt from the island's self-isolation requirements? And the same goes to anyone arriving in the Isle of Man who has had the vaccine. Will there be any kind of changes looking at making any changes there?
At the moment, the answer is no. And again, it's for the same principle that Henrietta's just discussed, in the fact that we don't yet have that information. This is a brand new vaccine, of how it interacts in terms of people being able to either contract the virus and then transmit it. And we need to have more evidence around that before we can be confident to go down any of those sorts of routes.
Okay, thank you.
And next up, it's over to Sam Turton from Isle of Man Newspapers. Good afternoon, Sam.
Good afternoon, Minister. I just wanted to start. We've had, we put a post on Facebook last night asking people's questions. And one we've had in, which was messaged in to us, came from a health worker who says they're not still certain about the virus. They're not entirely sure what happens if they, as health workers, say they will not be taking it in the immediate future.
Right, right. Well, the first thing I need to be absolutely clear on is that vaccination is not mandatory. We have never gone down the route in the island of vaccination being mandatory. And as Minister for Health, I've always made my position quite clear on that. I don't believe in mandatory vaccination. I think the reassurance that we can give is, like I say, although this has been produced at a much faster rate, most vaccines have maybe over a decade taken to go through the various stages. A lot of that is around the logistics and the resources. It's that that has been sped up. It is not the clinical safety stages or the trial stages. They have still got to go through the same processes in order for this vaccine to be approved. Catherine used the elderly mother test. The other test, which I'll save someone a question before they ask me it, is would I take the vaccine myself? And the answer is yes, I would. And I'll pass over to Henrietta if she's got anything to add.
No, other than to say that both my elderly mother, who was 99 last week, and myself, when I get to that point in the queue, will be coming forward for our vaccines.
Thank you. And just secondly, it sort of revolves back around borders. Will the government be considering its border policy going into the new year? I know your colleague, Mr. Skelly, spoke of the idea of still having a tourist season. Will the government be publishing new frameworks regarding what levels they need to see in the wider world, especially in the United Kingdom, in terms of opening the borders, even just to let relatives in and moving to that 3A, or will we be continuing with the current system?
Yeah, so I laid out before why we feel we can't move to 3A at the current time, and we recognise that will cause anxiety for quite a lot of people who want to see their relatives. But the one thing I can say is that we will be reviewing the situation again in the new year. We need to see what effect the lockdown has had in England and how the infection rate is moving. We've kept the borders framework under constant review. It's been reviewed every 2 weeks, and I can confirm that council and ministers will be reviewing it again early in the new year.
Thank you.
Okay, and next up I have Alex Bell from the BBC. Good afternoon, Alex.
Hello. Just to build on a couple of previous questions there, what kind of a shift in the border policy do you expect the initial vaccine rollout to herald? So you mentioned the 4 to 6 month rollout there. Can we expect anything beyond level 3 at the end of that initial 4 to 6 months?
Well, again, it depends what effect the vaccination has on infection rates, because that's what our border policy is based around, and quite rightly so. If we start seeing rapid declines in infection rates, particularly in our near neighbours, the UK and the Republic of Ireland, that will allow us to move through our border stages a lot quicker. So we're not necessarily reviewing the border stages as such. We're remaining with the plan and the different stages of reopening. But if the vaccination does start suppressing the virus and we start seeing lower infection rates in our near neighbours, we'll be able to move through those stages more quickly.
Thank you. And forgive me if this was answered in the earlier part of the press conference where the signal was cutting out slightly. Has much mind been given to the logistics of how the vaccine will be handed out in terms of where it will be done? Will it be done in doctors' surgeries? I know some countries have requisitioned large public venues, for example?
Yeah, I'll bring Catherine in a minute to talk more detail about the logistics. I do have to point out again, it is a huge logistical challenge, particularly with this particular vaccine, because of the temperatures that it has to be stored under, and the fact we now know we can't split the trays of the 975, and the fact that once you actually do start to move it to places, you can't just transport it a number of times. It's got to be very carefully handled. So there is a lot of logistics around this, but I'll let Catherine come in on some of the more detailed work that the team have been undertaking.
Hi, yes, absolutely. So actually it's going to be a blend of options, and it will also vary according to which vaccinations we're working with. So we refer to the Pfizer vaccination, which is obviously clearly the first vaccination that we're going to be having on the island, and the logistics with that. Our intention will be as best as we can in a mobile solution, in a safe way, to take those vaccines to care home residents and then ultimately the carers who care for them. But then, as I referred earlier, our intention would be one central hub where we would ask as many people as we can, obviously, to come to us in that scenario, and more information will follow on where that is, probably during next week. And then in relation to, as we roll out other vaccines, so everybody be aware of the Oxford vaccine, which is on its way. Actually, the level of volumes that we're expecting from Oxford are significantly greater than the Pfizer vaccine, and that will be much easier to administer. It'll be much easier logistically to manage, and it is our intention that it will then become a more community delivery. And as you've suggested, in GP surgeries, we know we've already had a number of community pharmacists who've offered to support, and we'll be welcoming that. So every single opportunity and every single route as we go through this over the next 9 months will be how we undertake this programme.
Thank you.
Okay, next up I have Rob Pritchard, 3FM. Good afternoon, Rob.
Good afternoon, Minister. Sorry, my signal's just been cutting in and out. Do apologise. My first question, just regarding the way the vaccine is delivered. There's two doses over the space of, I think it was mentioned, 21 days. In that gap between the first dose and the second, are there any extra precautions people will have to take? Because obviously, until they get that second dose, they won't be considered fully vaccinated.
Yeah, I'll bring Henrietta in, if I may, on that.
Yes, it looks as if they do get some immunity between doses as a result of the first dose, but it's certainly not full. And in fact, full immunity, full benefit, isn't reached until 7 days after the second dose. So it's very important that people follow all the regulations that may be in place at the time. Obviously here, if we stay as we are, life is pretty free, and there's no reason for somebody who's had the first shot of vaccine to behave any differently while they wait for the second. But yes, it will depend what's in force at the time that the programme is rolled out.
Yeah, the Commission on Human Medicine Expert Working Group yesterday said that the first jab does provide some partial immunity, but that's from about 12 days after the injection is taken. And then, as Henrietta said, after the second dose of the vaccine, 21 days after the first, people should see the full benefit of the immunity 7 days after that's been taken.
So just to clarify from what you've all just said there, you're looking at the closest thing to full protection from the vaccine after around 28 days or beyond that?
Yeah, that's correct.
And that's including the two doses. Okay, thank you, yes. My second question, is this vaccine going to be something that people only have to take once, or is it something we're going to have to see maybe once a year or every 6 months, for example?
Again, I'll bring Henrietta in a second, but to be frank, we don't know with the science. From my understanding, there is nothing yet that says how long the antibodies produced will actually stick around, what sort of although it's very positive, the science so far, around generation of T-cell response. The science, with this being brand new, we just do not know yet, but I'll hand over to Henrietta.
No, I absolutely concur with what the Minister's just said. What it does look like is that the immune response that is generated by the vaccine is better than the immune response that can be generated by actual infection with COVID, particularly mild infections, which often don't stimulate a very high antibody response, and the antibodies fall off quite quickly thereafter. The vaccine appears to confer longer-lasting immunity, but obviously we haven't had the time lapse to know how long that lasts. And whether we may end up needing to do repeat programmes, perhaps a bit akin to what we have to do with flu.
Okay, thank you.
And he's waited very patiently for us, but last but certainly not least, Paul Moulton from Isle of Man Television. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ashford. Like other people, we're hearing things and it was going a bit wobbly, but did I hear you're looking for volunteers and that those volunteers will be the ones that will be making these injections? Can you just clarify exactly what was said there?
So, right. So it's medical professionals, Paul, to be absolutely clear. We're not looking for general members of the public to come forward and say, yes, I'll vaccinate someone. It's retired GPs, retired nurses who already have the appropriate training, who then undergo a short training course on how to deliver the vaccine. We will be using our own health and care staff, of course, but basically it's all hands to the pump, Paul. This is the biggest vaccination programme that has basically been seen in human history. And if there are people out there with appropriate qualifications who wish to volunteer to help, then we'd be more than happy to hear from them. I'm delighted to say there's a lot of people that have already come forward. In fact, I think I've fielded three today of a retired GP and two retired nurses who've contacted me saying they're happy to help. And let's get it done as a community.
In all your tabletop exercises, surely this would be one you would see coming. So this could have been done months ago to get everyone up and running, ready for the big day, right?
Well, again, Paul, we've got to say this isn't going to be completely instant. This is a programme that is going to be spread out across quite a period of time. So I need to be quite clear on that because we need the supplies of the vaccine coming in. We need the logistics around delivering it. So it's not just a case of having a load of people in place and suddenly everything's going to be delivered in a month. That's not the case. This is, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint in terms of delivering a vaccine. And I need to get that message across again. All we are saying is if there are retired professionals out there and they wish to assist, we would be happy to hear from them. We've been hearing from several people for months now who've come forward and offered their services, for which we're very grateful.
Well, obviously, clearly you've thought about how people are going to be notified. So can you share with us, is it going to be a text? Will we be getting letters? I mean, everything's in place for that, right? You've done that part of the organisation ready for the vaccine, I'm guessing.
Yes, yeah, and I'll bring Catherine in to explain a bit more around that. Oh, so, sorry, Catherine. Yeah, we can hear you now.
Thank you. Yeah. So, yes, we have pretty much developed the booking processes. We actually expect those to be ready by the middle to the end of next week, which includes all the IT development that's gone with it. Initially, yes, individuals, according to the groups and those JCVI policy groups, priority groups that you've seen and been well publicised, will be invited. We'll be asking people to phone their phone 111, and then they'll be booked in from there. So that's how we manage it. That's how we manage the front end. And then there's a lot of administration that goes on at the back end in relation to how we record the vaccine that they've had and also how that's put on their GP record. So similarly, the processes are underway to order to manage that as well. So it's quite an extensive piece of work. And with reference to your question earlier, yes, we have been planning for a great number of this for a number of weeks now. Actually, the information has only really just started to come through. So, for example, as we sit here at the moment, we're still waiting for the final training package in relation to the actual COVID vaccine itself. So we are expecting that shortly. So it's actually at the right time now to put that call out for help. And as I've suggested earlier, we're looking for people to contact LEAD at gov.im or to telephone 685 714, 716, that's 685 716, and healthcare professionals who are willing to help.
Just to be clear, people have to ring in to get on the list. You haven't got the database and you'll just be calling us up as and when, because you must know exactly who are the oldest people out there who needs it first. You must have that. But you are actually saying people will need to ring in to get their booking if they fit the right criteria when you announce it.
That is correct, yes. The booking process will be done through 111, but they'll be invited by their GP according to the age groups, very similar to what we do now in relation to flu vaccinations. But yes, they will be asked to book via the 111 system, and we'll ask people to call in.
So
yes.
Paul, just to give you absolute clarity, Paul, there, so there's no confusion, people will be invited to come for their jab. So they will be contacted, and then basically they will be told to ring 111 to book the appointment to have the jab. Hopefully that makes it sounded a bit clearer for you as to how the process will work.
That clears up a lot. Otherwise, I was going to ask you, are you going to be swamped otherwise one-on-one, weren't you, for people wanting to get in the queue?
No, so hopefully that makes it clear. They will receive an invite, contact first, to say they're within the category, and then they will book the appointment to actually go and have the jab via 111.
Right. As I'm last, do you mind if I have a quick last
one? No, I'm going to let anyone else who's got additional questions have them
Thank you. There potentially could be three vaccines available. Now, we clearly hear this one's pretty difficult to deal with and there's all sorts of implications, but the two others that are coming through potentially could be licensed any day now. Therefore, the question is, will people get the choice to pick which one they want, or will they be told this is the one you're getting?
No, it won't be a choice, Paul, as to which one you get. We will be delivering a mix of vaccines across the programme. We do not have the ability, same as the UK, for people to pick and choose which particular vaccine they would prefer. In terms of the Oxford one, you're quite correct. It is a lot easier to handle. It's a lot more mobile. It's stored at regular fridge temperature. So we will be seeing the higher numbers as well of the Oxford vaccine. So we have to remember we've got to use the tools at our disposal. So no, it won't be a pick and choose.
Thank you. And we'll see you Monday for our usual chat.
You will indeed. We'll have our usual chat on Monday. And I'll bring in Tim Glover, who from Manx Radio, I think, syndicating's got an additional question.
Yes, thank you, Minister. We're just getting contacted quite a bit about, is it safe for pregnant women to receive the vaccine, and are there any other conditions and vulnerabilities that might have to be weighed in as to whether you have the vaccine now or not?
I'll bring Henrietta in on that.
Right. In respect of pregnant women, there is no data to indicate one way or the other. Theoretically, there is unlikely to be a risk to them, but that is not known, and therefore the current advice is that you shouldn't have the vaccine if you are pregnant. You should wait until you've had the child and then have it.
And are there any other conditions that people should bear in mind about whether they have the vaccine or not?
We're waiting for final, more detailed guidance on that, but this is not an attenuated virus, so it doesn't have the problems for immunosuppressed people that those live viruses do. So the question is whether the immunosuppressed would mount a sufficient reaction to it, and we're waiting for clarity on that, but there is no reason to be worried at this stage that they should not have it.
Thank you.
Simon from Business 365, you've got an additional question.
Thank you, Minister. Yes, it actually goes back to the earlier question about misinformation. And is government planning some kind of a media campaign to counter the misinformation?
We are planning a media campaign around the vaccination. It's going to be very hard to counter every single piece of misinformation out there, because particularly with the internet these days, things spread so quickly. We certainly will be going out with the messages around the headline ones. I picked on one earlier on, and also the misinformation that's there around the safety of the vaccine and the stages that it's been through. So we will certainly try and counter all of the headline ones, but with the best will in the world, the way social media and the internet works these days, it's very, very hard in real time to counter every bit of misinformation out there.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to our media partners for those questions. And I would just like to take the opportunity to again reinforce the point that this is a very strong development. It's a very important development in our fight against COVID-19. But in the words of the Chief Minister from a couple of weeks ago, while it might be a silver bullet, it's not a speeding silver bullet, and it will take time to roll out, and it is not going to be instant. We are not going to go from the situation we are in now to everything back to pre-COVID instantly. Christmas is now in sight. Advent calendars are being opened. The festive spirit is in the air. Big crowds enjoyed the switch-ons of the Christmas lights in Peel and Castletown last weekend, and festive events are being held this weekend across the island, many in support of local good causes. Also, according to the weatherman, some wintry weather and a touch of the white stuff may be on the way. I believe some may have already fallen on the mountain, I was reliably informed before coming in here. So enjoy the run-up to Christmas, and make the most of what our island has to offer. As the Chief Minister said last week, If we hold our course, work together and follow the rules, we can keep our community safe. Enjoy the festive season and protect our precious health and care services. Thank you very much.